From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, surrendering to the sequester, goodbye to the Pope, new U.S. aid to Syrian rebels, and big issues at the Supreme Court. President Obama spoke Tuesday in Newport News, Virginia, about the impact of the sequester effective today.
What the sequester does is it uses a meat cleaver approach to gut critical investments in things like education and national security, in life-saving medical research.
South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham criticized President Obama's leadership and his own party on the sequester on the Senate floor yesterday.
To me, this is pathetic leadership by the commander-in-chief. This is an abandonment of the Republican Party's belief in peace through strength. This is the low point in my time in the United States Congress.
And new U.S. millions promised to Syria's more moderate rebels to offset Islamist gains. Secretary of State John Kerry said it had to be done.
We do this because we need to stand on the side of those in this fight who want to see Syria rise again in unity and see democracy and human rights and justice.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Robert Costa of the National Review, Nancy Cordes of CBS News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. How has it come to sequester? Is this the best we can do? What are you thinking on the Pope, Syria, Bradley Manning, Dennis Rodman in North Korea? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Washington, Robert Costa, Washington editor at the National Review. Robert, welcome back to you as well.
Great to join you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Robert.
All right, Robert, they're sitting down at the White House, I guess, as we speak right now, McConnell and Boehner and Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi. Is there any chance in Hades of some puff of smoke over there on the sequester not happening?
I'm very skeptical, Tom, because when you see this White House meeting today, it's really for show. I was on Capitol Hill yesterday till late, and talking to Republicans, they don't seem eager at all to move on any kind of sequester resolution, especially one that includes revenue, and that's what President Obama keeps pushing for. And they don't think the Senate Democrats themselves are ready to make any kind of large-scale deal on the sequester, so I think it's being implemented today, and it's happening.
Nancy, help us understand all the, hinder talk, or ass, as John Boehner had it this week. On Tuesday, he came out and, there was all this trading of insults, John Boehner and Harry Reid. You'll hear Boehner first saying, look, we're working on this. What about the Senate? Get off their hinder.
We have moved a bill in the House twice. We should not have to move a third bill before the Senate gets off their ass and begins to do something.
Okay, Mr. Speaker, and here, you, as you well know, Nancy Reid's response later that same day.
I think he should understand who is sitting on their posterior. We're doing our best here to pass something. The Speaker is doing nothing to try to pass anything over there.
Their posterior, always a new twist. Nancy, was there anything anywhere in Congress this week that might realistically have, taken us off this train?
There was nothing. And to be honest with you, I think leaders decided long ago that they weren't even going to try to negotiate to avert the sequester, to weaken it, to change it, to make it less damaging. They have just tried and failed so many times before to get these big debt deals or spending cut deals that they didn't even attempt it. And so what this week was really about, sadly, was the leaders from both parties and the rank and file just doing their best to blame the other side, because that's all there was to do.
So let's look at the politics. Nancy, I'll put it first to you. How do you think this plays out politically?
Well, I really think it depends on just how damaging the sequester ends up being, and nobody's really quite sure how difficult it's going to be, and also how much of an outcry there is. If these cuts roll out slowly, and yes, there's pain here and there, but there isn't a big backlash against Congress, against the president, from people particularly in states that are hard hit by some of these military cuts, then you may not see much happening. Maybe they'll tinker around the edges, give the agencies more flexibility to impose these cuts in ways that make more sense, but I don't think you'll see any large-scale negotiation to try to change it. if there's a big hue and cry and members of Congress see their, you know, their offices or switchboards flooded by calls from people saying this is crazy, then maybe we'll see some action.
The president saying Wednesday night, this is a business council dinner in Washington, that it's all political, that what would be required, in his view, some cuts from Democrats, some revenues with Republicans cooperating. Here's the president.
The issue is political. And the question is whether or not we are going to see a willingness on the part of all parties to compromise in a meaningful way. And what that means is Democrats have to accept the need for entitlement reform. But it also means that Republicans have to accept the need for additional revenues.
John Boehner in a press conference the next day saying no, no on revenues, no more.
The revenue issue is now closed. Any revenue generated by closing loopholes should be used to lower rates across the board for American families. How much more money do we want to steal from the American people to fund more government? I'm for no more.
Robert Costa, how do you interpret how the two parties are interpreting the fallout here?
It's been a rocky couple of months for House Republicans. They feel especially burned, the backbenchers, the conservatives, about how the fiscal cliff was handled. They look at how John Boehner let some of the Bush tax cuts expire, and they remain frustrated about what happened in January. So John Boehner has very little maneuvering room right now with the president. The president may be asking for revenue, but on a political basis, the House Republicans can't move on revenue or tax increases without alienating the entire conservative movement. So I don't expect John Boehner to do anything like that. What you will see John Boehner do, however, is try to push potentially to replace these cuts. You hear rumblings on Capitol Hill that Republicans are open to the idea of giving the president discretion to pick new cuts to replace the current sequester cuts. Because Nancy's right, there is a potential outrage in a lot of Republican districts that have military personnel and military bases, and defense hawk Republicans are being very unhappy about these Pentagon cuts. But on a broad basis, Republicans are very supportive of spending cuts, and they look at these cuts as a drop in the bucket, 0.25% of GDP, and they want Republicans to push for them. So Republicans are treading carefully in how they try to replace them.
Are you saying that today or soon they might still give the president the power then to replace these broad acts across the board cuts with more surgical cuts that would, you know, spare
this? That's exactly
right.
Because most Republicans don't want to see the Pentagon slashed and burned. They think the Pentagon needs to be curbed in its spending. But they'd like to if any solution happens, from what I hear from Republicans, it's going to be making the president be even more responsible for the sequester, letting him pick perhaps better cuts. And the president is also very wary because he has a lot of Democrats who are up for re-election as well in 2014 in districts and states that are going to be very much affected by this sequester. And so the president, from what I hear, may be open to the idea of trying to pick some better cuts while allowing Republicans not to get burned by their base by allowing revenue.
Jack Beatty, here's the heart of government function thrashing around. Nobody wanted this to happen when it was put in place, as far as I know. You tell me. How do you see the big picture here, Jack? What is happening?
Well, you know, the Senate chaplain yesterday, just before the debate on the sequester, both Republican answers to it and Democratic answers were defeated. The Senate chaplain said, "Please save us from ourselves, Lord." Well,
he has to say that more and more often these days.
Please, we beg you.
Didn't work.
I hear that a lot.
He was busy elsewhere. Well, you know, just descending into the details of this for a minute, I think Speaker Boehner really was throwing a liberal dose of gorilla dust, to quote Ross Perot, into the public eye when he said that the House had already passed its bills and the Senate was sitting on its keister. You know, three points about that. The two bills he's referring to were passed in the last Congress. They have no existence in this Congress. Second, the bills went nowhere then with the Senate because they cut domestic discretionary spending even more severely than the sequester. Not only that, they cut the resolution authority in Dodd-Frank. They cut some money from Obamacare, non-starters. And number three, that bill passed, the December bill passed just narrowly in the House, 215 to 209. With 21 Republicans voting no, 16 of the 21 are still in Congress, whereas 30 Republicans who voted yes for that are gone. In other words, Boehner doesn't have the votes to put through what he did in the last Congress.
So look through the gorilla dust. What's the position? If this is this just lumbering here? Is this positioning? If it's positioning, who's ending up well-positioned, if anyone?
Well, I mean, the polls show that the president is leading on this. The public agrees with him on a balanced approach. That's for now. But beyond this, we're going to have, you know, look ahead. In another month, we're going to have the continuing resolution. In the summer, we're going to have the debt ceiling again. All of these obstructions. And who gains from obstruction? I mean, Mike Lofgren, a GOP aide who quit Congress in 2011 and wrote this piece called Goodbye to All That, basically pointed out, he said, you know, obstruction helps the party that is programmatically opposed to government. In other words, the Republicans can very well say to the electorate, look, nothing is happening in this government, can't you see? And we're the ones who can administer.
But is that burn down the village to save it?
I don't know even about saving it. It certainly may be trying to wring political profit from obstruction.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Sequester Day, Pope, no more. U.S. aid to Syrian rebels, Bradley Manning's plea. Nancy Cordes is with us from CBS News. Robert Costa from the National Review. Jack Beatty's here. Robert Costa, jump in with us here on the politics of this. I mean, people have all kinds of questions here. Jack says John Boehner doesn't have the votes, even if he wanted to. We've got a listener here writing to us on a line, says, you know, across-the-board cuts are precisely what so-called conservatives have long advocated. Tea Partiers now in control of the Republican Party, have finally given them the opportunity to implement that policy. How do you read Republican politics around this? What freedom did Boehner have? Is he happy with the situation he's in? Is he in control, Robert?
Not really. I think it's very easy to look at the Congress and say that the House Republicans are in disarray, because it's very true. They're a confused party right now. There's tensions within the ranks. Leadership doesn't have a strong hold over the conference. But I think the bigger question is, when you look at the White House, they're doing a lot of things strategically that probably have both positives and negatives for them in solving the sequester. The president has not come to Capitol Hill and tried to hash out a deal with Speaker Boehner and Harry Reid. They're having a meeting today, but this meeting on Friday was scheduled on Tuesday. And the perception, fairly or not, on Capitol Hill among Republicans, that the president isn't serious about being a legislative negotiator. But the president, of course, is winning the PR battle. So if you're a White House strategist, you're probably pretty confident about where you stand right now, because when the president goes to military bases or states with a lot of defense industry companies, he sounds confident. He feels like the public's back in his position, pushing for revenue, pushing for taxes as some kind of replacement for the sequester. But the problem is, as much as the president's winning the PR battle, I don't think the president's really moving towards any kind of deal that could solve it. I think that's always been the problem for the president. He's a master at winning the message war. Republicans are often incompetent. But when it comes to actually crafting something, the president's not really able to dot the I and cross the T.
Nancy, what about that? The charge then that comes out of Congress is, where's the leadership? We heard it at the top of the hour. Where's the commander-in-chief, Lindsey Graham, saying?
Well, I think the challenge for the White House in this particular situation and why they decided not to engage is that if Republicans are making a blanket statement that they will not accept any tax revenue increases as part of a sequester replacement deal, then what's in it for the White House to try to negotiate some kind of replacement? It's not clear that what they get is going to be all that much better than what they have now. They don't like spending cuts. So rearranging the deck chairs, as they put it, isn't that much more palatable to them. So they'd rather just go out and crusade about how bad the sequester is, and then maybe down the line, if it is as bad as they say, and there is some debate about that, then, you know, if they've got the public on their side, they think maybe in a month or 2 months, then they can, you know, they'll have more power to force House Republicans to bend on this issue. The other challenge for the White House with this whole idea of giving them more flexibility, which sounds really great, right? You know, then you can save really important programs and you can cut ones that aren't as important. But then it really truly becomes the president's sequester. Then he is the one who is making cuts to beloved programs, to programs that employ people. And it really ties the sequester around the president's neck when it's something he doesn't like to begin with. So that's why the White House issued a veto threat against this Republican proposal to give him more flexibility.
Don't hand that to me.
As a catch 22.
Right. Oh, boy. Paul in Lincoln, Nebraska. Paul, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just have to tell you, I got to laugh a little bit about all the energy we expend when we're looking at the process here. I mean, this is like making sausage. the government is operating exactly as the American people voted and exactly as the Constitution provides. I mean, we have divided government. We're going to get a little bit of tax increase. We're going to get a little bit of spending cut. And I think the thing that's missing here is leadership, somebody willing to take up and actually take a couple of bullets for the American people.
Well, I mean, yes, it's what the Constitution set up, and it's what the vote gives us in terms of a representation there. But does it have to be this painful and sloppy along the way, Paul?
I think the missing element is executive leadership. If the president wants to have a better process, that's what a CEO is supposed to do. And we're not talking about a corporate CEO. We're talking about a governmental CEO, which is a totally different animal.
Yep.
But if we want a true progress in this country, it's time for the president to step up and convince the American people that there's something better ahead and then work in that direction. And he's not doing that right now.
Well, he's sure been out there talking, but maybe you're right. It's not working. Jack Beatty, boil it down. Where do you see the basics of this? Paul looks at it from Lincoln, Nebraska, and says, look, that's the way we voted. That's our Constitution. There we are.
Well, yeah, we have, to misuse a phrase of John C. Calhoun's, we have concurrent majorities. We have the presidential majority twice now, and we have the Tea Party majority, which has also been elected twice. And they're in collision. You know, in fairness, the president is offering hundreds of billions of dollars in cuts in Social Security. In fact, current recipients of Social Security with the CPI, change CPI, and in his State of the Union, he mentioned cuts in Medicare. This is something the Republican leadership has been asking for years. So there it is. At least that looks like a compromise to me, but they will not compromise, not on tax, rate increases. They won't compromise even on more tax revenue. They won't do anything that raises tax, that closes loopholes for hedge fund managers and so on. And I don't think it's related to any views about the economy. I just think it's stark terror. I mean, Ron Johnson, the Republican senator from Wisconsin this week, said if Mr. Boehner went along with a tax increase or maybe even allowed a vote on that, he would lose his job. And that's probably the case. And when look at the Senate. Senator McConnell, up for re-election in 2014, mm-hmm. his deputy, Senator Cornyn in Texas, the same thing. And when they look across to their co-senators, Senator McConnell sees Rand Paul, Tea Party senator, and Cornyn sees Ted Cruz, Tea Party. Are those fellows ready to vote for tax increases? No way.
Robert in Burlington, Vermont. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, guys. So Boehner and McConnell, they say they're done compromising, that they've already compromised all that they're willing to do at the fiscal cliff at the new year about taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what happened in the fiscal cliff. Instead of Obama's proposal that would raise people above $250K to the Clinton-era taxes,
right.
The compromise went to people who make, and that would have been the top 2% of the taxpayers. The compromise went to, it was only the people above $450K.
Mm-hmm.
That got their rates changed back to the Clinton-era taxes, and that's the top 0.7%. So for 99.3% of the taxpayers, what happened was the Bush-era tax rates got turned from law that sunsetted every 2 years that they, I would come up again for 2 years later. Instead of sunsetting, it turned into permanent law. These guys got the Bush-era tax rates converted into permanent law for 99.3% of the taxpayers. What did they give up?
Very little, you're saying, Robert. Looks like a good deal for the Republican leadership, I guess, as you see it anyway. Robert Costa, what about this? The president out this week saying the Republicans are trying to balance the budget on the backs of the middle class and hold, rich backers exempt from that. You hear our caller's analysis of what happened in December and where we stand on taxes now. I mean, what is the thinking here, Robert?
Republicans aren't that worried about the sequester. They understand the news stories could be damaging to them back home. But look, Republicans have fought for the last 2 or 3 years on spending cuts, and these are real spending cuts. That's what they always say when they talk to reporters. These are real spending cuts. They go into effect now, at least most of them, $44 billion at least of the 85 go into effect immediately. And so they look at the fiscal year, and they see that on September 30th, there's going to be a new appropriations process, and Republicans will probably be able to figure out with Democrats a way to replace a lot of these cuts at the end of the year. So they just have to swallow sequestration between now and September 30th. And in a political climate where the Democrats control the White House and the Senate, and House Republicans are constantly fighting to actually get some spending cuts, a lot of people in the House Republican Conference are cheering it. The one group of Republicans that are very unhappy are the defense-friendly Republicans, the defense hawks, because they think the party under George W. Bush especially became known as a defense party, and now that they're cheering the sequester simply because it's spending cuts, they may be losing that element of the party that's about military spending, about building up America's forces.
Nancy, how do you see, if the president says that we're not going to do this just on the middle class, as he frames it, mm-hmm. Republicans say no new revenues, how do we get out of that headlock?
Well, we don't. I mean, this is the headlock that we've been in for the past 2 years. This is the reason that we got the sequester in the first place. I still remember, you know, when it was the backup to the backup. That's how it all started. The president was debating with John Boehner over a big debt reduction package. That blew up. So they said, okay, let's have this super committee try to do it instead. And if they can't do it, then we'll have this sequester. And no one ever thought the sequester was going to happen, truly. You know, everyone thought, you know, we've got 12 smart members of Congress working on this for months. They've got to be able to figure this out. And they couldn't. And after they couldn't, I think the will to try to figure something out among leadership just plummeted, because they thought, you know, how many times are we going to go through this painful exercise without being able to accomplish anything?
But the, you know, here we are, Bernanke's saying we're going to lose, what, a half a point off growth, maybe a little more this year. That's not a pretty picture. Everybody wants to get back to better times economically.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. John, Charleston, South Carolina. John, you're on the air.
Yeah. The government's being asked to cut $86 billion in the sequester.
Mm-hmm.
The budget for this year is $2.3 trillion, somewhere around there, correct?
Huge, yes.
And so that's far less than 1% of the budget. Now, American workers like myself and like you, we just took a 2% payroll cut with the increase in the payroll tax in January 1st.
Bringing it back, yeah.
I had to learn to do with 2% less come January 1st. And the government can't even do with $86 billion less?
Well, I take your point, John, but you know, but when you make that cut at home, you don't take a little bit out of everything. You decide where you're going to cut it. I mean, can't we be smarter than this, John, in the way we make cuts?
Well, that's it. You know, I say give the government a chance to cut where it needs to be cut, but still $86 billion cut without raising taxes ought to be easy to do.
Nancy, I hear you there. What do you say?
Well, keep in mind that, yes, when you look at the overall government spending, it is 2%. But our biggest expenditures on things like Medicare and Social Security are basically unscathed. And so the cuts coming out of defense and out of domestic agencies are much greater than that. They are 10%, 13%. And that is a big hit. I mean, a family that has to go from one day to the next, cutting 13% of its budget, that's painful.
Certainly the Pentagon's really yelling about it. And I'm sure we will hear more as meat inspectors don't show up for their jobs and all the rest. Robert Costa, help us understand, in the midst of this drama, there's another drama, a related drama around Bob Woodward of Watergate fame, of course, and much more, where he's in this tiff with the White House. They didn't like his characterization of what happened back in those grand bargain days of a couple summers ago. He says he was threatened by the White House, by a senior White House official. Of course, Gene Sperling is the word that's come down. Here was Woodward. We need your interpretation on this, Bob. Here he was on Wednesday talking with CNN's Wolf Blitzer. Woodward, then Blitzer.
It was said very clearly, you will regret doing this.
Who sent that email to you?
Well, I'm not going to say.
It's a senior person at the White House.
And just as a man, I mean, it makes me very uncomfortable to have the White House telling reporters you're going to regret doing something that you believe in.
Watergate man says he's threatened by Obama White House for his description of what happened. The next day, we had Jay Carney, White House press secretary, saying there's no, you can't read these emails between Gene Sperling, the top economic advisor to the president, and Woodward, and think that Sperling was being threatening.
Gene Sperling, in keeping with a demeanor I have been familiar with for more than 20 years, was incredibly respectful, referred to Mr. Woodward as his friend, and apologized for raising his voice. I think you cannot read those emails and come away with the impression that Gene was threatening anybody.
Robert Costa, it's almost as though they're saying, you know, Obama's got a Nixon's enemies list here, or I don't know. What's going on with this?
When you look at Bob Woodward's email exchange with Gene Sperling, I think it's fair to debate whether Gene Sperling was actually being combative. I think Woodward may be overcooking his interpretation of the word regret. But I will say this. I think this entire episode with Bob Woodward in the White House is a healthy discussion to be having about how the White House deals with the press. I have many friends. I myself cover the White House about once a week. People are very unhappy with how the White House is dealing with access issues and how it handles information and how it deals with reporters. And so as much as this Woodward email about regret with Sperling may be overdone and Woodward may be taking it a bit too far, at the same time, I think a lot of this comes back to the White House's unhealthy relationship with many reporters. And so I think it's good once in a while, regardless of the situation, for the White House to have to deal with its press situation and look internally about whether it's doing the right thing in terms of how it handles the press.
Boy, but over time, it's not as though Bob Woodward has really had issues with access, over time anyway. He himself said he never characterized it as a threat. What do you see going on here, Jack? Is this just a total tempest in a teapot, Washington, the theater?
It's beginning to look that way because, you know, if you look at Woodward's response via email in real time to Sperling, he writes, you do not have to apologize for me. I, for one, welcome a little heat. Well, he said, and then now he goes on television and he says, they're threatening me. You know, it's interesting to look at conservative bloggers who seized on this and said, you know, there we go, shades of Nixon. Well, here Byron York is writing, we've been played, after he saw this Woodward email to Sperling. And Eric Erickson of the Red State says there's no threat here. So it looks as if Bob Woodward is trying to draw some attention to himself. I mean, mean-spirited people are saying, well, here's a great way to sell his book, which didn't do as well as his usual blockbusters last year. Who knows? But it doesn't look and then you have today you have our people like Major Garrett, our friend, and others saying, boy, oh boy, you know, this is what goes with the territory. People talk rough up here, and
sure,
we don't take it as a threat.
I mean, one can well imagine LBJ don't get us started. Nancy, where is the exit from this kind of what seems like just endless Sturm und Drang and too much drama and too much kind of dead-headed confrontation in Washington? We have to wait for midterms? Is it even there?
I wish I knew. I don't see a major exit. I actually think that, this latest sorry episode with the sequester aside, we actually have seen a little more bipartisanship up here on Capitol Hill than we have in the past. The two sides trying to work together, perhaps on immigration, perhaps on guns. So we do see some points of light in a dark landscape.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Unusual events this week. Pope Benedict is no more. Now he's Pope Emeritus. Here he is yesterday out of the Vatican blessing a crowd outside the church's Castel Gandolfo in the hills outside Rome.
Padre e Figlio e Spirito Santo. Grazie, buonanotte. Grazie a tutti.
Good night and thank you all. And off goes the Pope. A spectacular explosion and hot air balloon crash in Luxor, Egypt. 19 tourists killed. A long, fiery drop to the ground. Two amazingly survived, including the pilot aboard another balloon. Eyewitness Christopher Mitchell was there.
It was more of what we heard. A loud explosion and then a lot of smoke right behind us.
And First Lady Michelle Obama made a surprise appearance at the Academy Awards by video link from the White House, announcing the award for Best Picture.
And the Oscar goes to Argo. Congratulations.
And it's Argo, announced from the White House. Wonder what if it had been Zero Dark 30 with that torture controversy. We're looking at a week in the news. Sequester Day, Pope No More, U.S. aid to Syrian rebels, Bradley Manning's plea. Robert Costa is here from the National Review. Nancy Cordes from CBS News, our own Jack Beatty. Got to look around the world just a little bit. Ties back to Washington, but we've got the Syrian situation where Islamists among the rebels appear to be taking the lead in many circumstances, better backed than a more moderate, more secular, or at least less hardline religious forces there, and concern in the U.S. about it. Here's Republican Senator Marco Rubio on Wednesday talking about the need to support a friendly stripe of Syrian rebels.
The best organized, the best armed, and the best equipped elements in Syria are the most radical ones, the most anti-democratic ones, the most anti-American ones. And that's a problem in the context of what I've just outlined to you, and that is that secondary conflict that's emerging. And so there's the real risk that when Assad falls, and he will fall, the largest, most well-equipped, best-organized groups in that conflict will be the people that, quite frankly, are against our national interests.
Marco Rubio in Washington, Secretary of State John Kerry out on the road talking with Syrians this week and saying we've got $60 million for bandages and civilian stuff, not military. Nancy, are we edging closer to getting in militarily with what are seen as the more friendly rebels here?
Well, this is a big debate going on in the administration right now. I mean, we learned not that long ago that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had supported giving the rebels ammunition. And then in a hearing the other day, the outgoing Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, was asked, and almost as an aside, said, yes, I also supported giving weapons to the rebels. And so clearly the White House was a bit alone on this front. They're holding out. And as of now, the president is still opposed to giving those weapons, although, you know, who knows what's happening covertly. But this is a debate, and obviously there are a lot of Republicans on the Hill who think that the rebels should be armed. And I just wonder, now that you've got the outgoing Secretary of Defense admitting that they also wanted to do this, whether that's going to put a lot of pressure on the White House.
Robert Costa, do you see body language changing here? Does John Kerry bring a different perspective to it? Could President Obama be open? I mean, the stakes are very high in what happens in Syria. And we're all watching the Islamists kind of out front in a lot of these attacks.
It really is a growing issue in foreign policy circles. And from what I'm hearing from conservatives here in Washington, they think they can push the administration to try to provide ammunition and weapons to the Syrian opposition forces, to the more moderate Syrian rebels, because there is a fear that among, I think, all parties, that Syria is a hotbed for potential terrorist activity. It could be a place at the very least, of unrest. And the U.S. has an interest there, and bandages are a very positive thing to a country undergoing severe change, but at the same time, it may need some armed forces.
Laura in Worcester, Massachusetts. Laura, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Great. I believe that we have a responsibility to Syria. If we were to do what was right in the case of Egypt and Libya, then we certainly should help Syria. And I wish we had stepped in a long time ago.
But, I mean, after our long, painful experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, do you really want another one of those?
Well, we went down that slippery slope when we stepped in with Egypt. And I do think it's the right thing to do. I think we did it because it's part of who we are. It's part of our core values and our beliefs as Americans. And it's the right thing to do. And especially with the genocide and the things that have been going on, I sat next to a woman from Syria on a plane coming home from Florida a few months back, and I was still pretty unaware of what was going on, and I was horrified to hear her story and the fear in her voice, and so grateful for her that she made it here, but the thoughts of her family and the others back there and the questions that they had about why we would help Egypt, why we would be there for Libya and not them. I couldn't answer those, and I was embarrassed and horrified.
Laura, I appreciate your call. Jack, you know, it does tug at your heartstrings when you see these rebels fighting a tyrant and also saying, but wait a minute, we don't want to have a fundamentalist nation here. We want something more open, and the U.S. hanging back as they appear to be sort of falling back in the fight.
Yes, you know, let's roll the clock back. Suppose the president had gone along with, I guess, the CIA, defense, and the Secretary of State, and armed the rebels starting last year. Well, then, what happened in Damascus just about 2 weeks ago was a bombing, al-Nusra bombing that killed, I think, 75 civilians. And these things have been going on. We would be, you know, money is fungible.
Yeah.
We'd be partly responsible for that. I mean, they're all on the same side. So, you know, the morality is very complicated. In some ways, this is getting to look like the Spanish Civil War of the 30s, where you had, yes, initially a liberal government trying to defend itself against the fascists. Then the Allies said, nope, we're going to have an arms embargo, just as here. And the result was that only the Soviets would supply the Republic, and the Republic became more and more under their influence. So you had a choice between Franco and a communist-dominated government. How does liberalism win there? And this is getting to look like that now. I mean, maybe this will help. Certainly this will help on the humanitarian side, and that's important. But, you know, you start giving these people weapons and you're responsible for the bloodshed.
Well, true, but if you don't drive the bus, you don't know where it's going. I mean, you don't know where it's going if you do drive. But
that's
but
true.
I mean, the stakes here, Robert Costa, could be quite amazing with regional people talk about meltdown.
They really are. And you just keep hearing that that Syria is bubbling up in the way that Egypt did a couple years ago. It's becoming something that Republican politicians used to talk about in vague terms, but now it's becoming the issue on foreign policy. And I don't think this is going to fade away. And I think this is going to be a real test for Secretary of State John Kerry. Just got into the position, and this is a difficult issue. It has to do a lot with the administration's foreign policy, its strategy in the Middle East. So as we move from the Clinton era to the Kerry era, I'm very interested to see what the man from Massachusetts does.
Kerry talking about needing to support forces which may lead to unity, something like democracy and justice. Also talking about Iran, very much tied into this close ally of Syria, and the nuclear question always there. New Secretary of State signaling, hey, we are again open to a diplomatic solution. Here he was in London on Monday.
The window for a diplomatic solution simply cannot, by definition, remain open forever. But it is open today. It is open now. And there is still time, but there is only time if Iran makes the decision to come to the table and to negotiate in good faith.
Nancy Cordes, new voice, but boy, have we been hearing this for a long time. Is anything really changing on this front? Does John Kerry bring a new dynamic?
What else can he really say? You know, I mean, there are limited ways to put pressure on Iran. There have already these, you know, very powerful sanctions. And yes, he can say the window may close at some point in the future. But let's be frank, if at any point Iran were to say, okay, we really want to sit down and talk, of course, the U.S. administration is going to sit down and talk. And back to Syria for a moment, I think the biggest challenge for the administration is, you know, once we supply these weapons, we are involved. And then what's the game plan? What's our exit strategy? It's not like Libya, where, you know, you've got a weakened dictator and, you know, you supply some air power for, you know, a couple of weeks and he's out of there. This is a much more difficult situation. And so, yes, you know, from a humanitarian perspective, they would like to go in. But from a strategic perspective, you arm them and then what?
Yeah. Alan in Charlotte, North Carolina. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make a comment on Syria. I think that we need to have a much better long-term plan in terms of the Middle East and how Syria fits in there. You know, I know a lot of Republicans are saying we should supply arms or be more involved on the military side, but I think history has shown that we've been inept when it comes to the Middle East in terms of long-term benefits from our military involvement there. And I think, you know, providing humanitarian aid, non-armed humanitarian aid, is the best in terms of in Syria, because we don't know who's going to win out between these more militant factions and the more liberal factions, number one. Number two, we have Iran there, and we have a complicated situation with them in terms of our negotiations and everything. So I think, you know, the best thing to do is to provide humanitarian aid, medical aid to all of the rebel factions. And I think in the long term, that'll turn out to be smarter than to have supported
you know, these liberal factions that may or may not lose to the more organized.
Alan, we've got it, though. You know, it'll be interesting to watch Washington if the trend goes toward an Islamist regime in Syria out of all this. Watch the knuckles whiten in Washington as that train moves. If it does. Let's talk about Bradley Manning in this context. Private Bradley Manning has been in prison for a while now after all those huge leaks that he engineered to WikiLeaks. He's pled guilty this week to 10 criminal counts here. He could be going away for a long time, up to 20 years in prison. Jack Beatty, how do you look at this private who had access to so much data in our new age? And off he goes with his plea.
Well, I'm struck by the statement he made to the court. He said, "I believe the public release of these cables would not damage the United States. However, I did believe the release might be embarrassing." Now, maybe I haven't been up on everything, but that's been my impression, that on the whole, these were embarrassing.
He said he wanted to spark a debate about foreign policy. He wanted the public to know what happens and why it happens. And certainly, we learned a lot.
We certainly did, and I'm not aware of any harm. Now, of course, what do I know?
Yeah.
But maybe there was harm.
Been charged. Hillary Clinton said there was harm.
Indeed, but we haven't really seen the proof of that. I don't know whether that'll come out. Now he's pled guilty, so perhaps it won't come out. But I did read that, and I thought, yeah, it was embarrassing. Was it harmful? Did it really in any way violate the Espionage Act, a very dubious piece of legislation put through in 1917 under which Debs was sent to jail for basically just, you know, saying, well, I don't know whether we need a draft or not. And then when you look at some of the things he talked about, he said he did expose the shooting of some Reuters correspondents from the air.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he said, and then a second group of people showed up in that video, and he said they were shot, but they weren't threats. They were good Samaritans. I mean, it's, you know, his representations here seem to be truthful about what these things reveal. So I'm just very ambivalent about the whole thing. I see him as, yes, he shouldn't have done this, and he even admits he did wrong, but he did help spark a debate about U.S. foreign policy.
And in a time when many things were going wrong.
Yes.
I want to turn to the Supreme Court. Our time grows short. Nancy Cordes, some very vocal skepticism from conservative justices this week about that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. The sense that maybe this will go down. What was the justices? Did you pay attention? What was the justices' problem with, you know, keeping this law on the books to keep voting as vertical and straight up as possible, plumb as possible, in the states where that has historically been a problem?
Right. Well, the strongest criticism came from Justice Scalia, who called the Voting Rights Act an example of racial entitlement, a racial entitlement, which obviously struck a lot of...
What does that mean? Isn't it a universal entitlement among citizens?
I guess what he meant was that you are giving preference to a group of people, in this case, African Americans, that gets perpetuated long after it's needed because Republicans and Democrats are afraid to vote against it because then they're afraid that they will look like a racist. So that was his argument. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor on the other side, you know, came back very strongly and questioned the lawyers in this case about whether they saw it as a racial entitlement. And,
she looked at problems in the very county bringing this appeal and said, look, it's still on the books. You've got problems.
Right. And some of these areas have had problems quite recently. Mm. On the other hand, these states are saying, why are we being treated differently than other states? We have a right to be able to make our own decisions about our voting laws. And so, this is going to be a very interesting case. It appeared that the five most conservative justices might be interested in striking down part of this law, but you never really know until the decision comes out.
Robert Costa, what do you make of the argument to let it go? Enough already. We're finished with that need.
Well, I think Scalia's comment drew gaffes in the at the Supreme Court because it was incendiary remark, and it was a remark that set off a lot of headlines. But I think what if you, listening to Scalia's whole statement and reading it again, you come to the decision, at least my perspective, is that he's mulling the entire act, and he wonders, just in general, if a law that has to do with preventing race discrimination in voting, if it's that suspicious, and he's just raising questions and red flags. In typical Scalia fashion, he did it with a lot of bravado and some strong rhetoric, but in terms of his legal argument, he's just looking at how it happened in 1965, how people dissented then, and now in today's society, is it necessary, is it even constitutional to have this kind of law dealing with voting?
We will watch how that one unfolds and more. The White House swinging in this week, asking for reconsideration at the court of California's Prop 8 on gay marriage and more. Listeners still thinking about sequestration. At least Americans have a sense of humor. They're writing in on movie titles for the sequestration debate. Here's the Buckeye says, "I know what you did last sequester." Here's "Honey, I sequestered the kids." Here's "You had me at sequest." And here, "Driving Miss Daisy because Amtrak is unfunded." Well, we'll see. Oh, boy. You got to have a sense of humor to get through here. Nancy Curtis with CBS. It is always great to have you with us. Thank you so much for being with us today, Nancy.
Thank you for having me.
Robert Costa at National Review. Wonderful of you to join us, Bob. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.